Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, company stuff, some real estate stuff, and a quick trip to South Carolina. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 12th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hey, you know what starts happening long about this time every single quarter? All right. Might be that I've oversold it with my excitement, but we are coming up on earnings season. We're talking corporate profits and losses sometimes in the second quarter. That is April through June. Tomorrow gets us Pepsi and JPMorgan Chase and Goldman Sachs. Wednesday, it is Delta Airlines and the rest of the big banks. Thousands of other smaller, lesser-known companies as well. And to put it, well, conservatively, Wall Street analysts are thinking we are going to see blockbuster, crazy high, best in more than a decade earnings growth compared to the second quarter last year, which, as we all remember, was terrible. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off then with what those earnings might be able to tell us about this economy.
We're likely to be working the superlatives hard as we take stock of corporate America's balance sheet.
We're sort of reaching for the stars.
Sam Stovall is chief investment strategist at CFRA Research.
Estimates are for a 61% year-on-year increase in S&P 500 earnings.
He predicts triple-digit gains for banks and consumer products companies with
the biggest gain in the industrial sector, a 330% rise, because basically we came off an incredibly low level a year ago.
And that comparison to the deep pandemic downturn is a big part of the story, says Ross Mayfield at Baird.
You've got a burgeoning recovery and you're comparing to the depths of a crisis.
But that crisis also drove a lot of companies to become more nimble and profitable, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
Businesses took the pandemic as an opportunity to rein in their costs and make big changes that they might not do in more typical times to improve productivity and make their businesses more efficient.
And at this point, there is still a lot of financial fuel, especially from government stimulus, to keep the boom going, says University of Maryland emeritus economist Peter Morici.
Just how much money is laying around in people's savings accounts on the balance sheets of banks, corporations? They have a lot of cash to spend.
Analysts do expect profit gains to gradually ramp down next year. And the pullback could happen sooner if some downside risks pan out, like persistent wage and price inflation from labor shortages and supply chain disruptions, or wider outbreaks of COVID variants worldwide. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've got a story coming up from Mamie Scott in just a bit about home prices and the I word. But there is a report out from the real estate site Redfin about factors that go into home prices. Those prices in places where you pretty much have to have a car to get around have grown twice as fast as they have in places with access to good public transportation. And of course, since the pandemic, a whole lot fewer people are using public transit, even in cities that have largely reopened. So those transit agencies are trying to come up with new ways to get those riders back, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Before COVID, about 5.5 million people rode the subway in New York City every weekday. On a good day now, that number is close to 2.5 million.
We're getting there, but obviously we'd like to get there a lot faster than we have been.
Sarah Feinberg is the interim president of New York City Transit. She says the system is trying to encourage more people back onto trains and buses with a big marketing campaign.
Educating our potential returning riders about all that we're doing to keep them safe in the system.
And also offering a few little perks, like
partnering with museums to offer people discounts if they take public transit to get to the museum.
Public transportation agencies all around the country are trying to find ways, big and small, to get riders back, says Paul Skoutelis, CEO of the American Public Transportation Association.
Many systems are really doing comprehensive route redesigns, reimagining their networks, concentrating on making sure they're servicing the essential workers.
And he says many are also looking at pricing, temporarily reducing fares, or in a few cases, even making rides free. In San Francisco, Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART tickets, will be half price for the month of September. Adi Tomer at the Brookings Institution says those kinds of incentives will get some riders back, but ultimately...
Transit agencies' best tool is one they do not control. The reopening of workplaces across the country.
Especially, he says, in big city downtowns. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the prospect of those crazy corporate earnings? Yeah, that. We'll have the details, all the green, when we do the numbers. We take the program now to Spartanburg, South Carolina, which you might call a global local economy there, thanks in no small part to BMW, which has its biggest factory anywhere in Spartanburg County. And now, 30-something years later, there is a whole industrial ecosystem grown up around it. David Britt is the chairman of the Spartanburg County Economic Development Committee. I met him on a trip down there about 4 or 5 years ago, so we have gotten him on the phone to see what's what now. David, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you too, Kai.
So it's been about a year, actually, since we were in touch. And things were, as most things were a year ago, a little tenuous in Spartanburg County. How are things now?
Far better than we ever imagined or could have ever planned. It's been incredible.
So if I were to get on a plane and come back down to Spartanburg and go out to you know, have a bite to eat or something, what's the mood, I think, is the question in, you know, upcountry South Carolina?
You probably would not recognize Spartanburg from when you were here last. We're having 20.6 people move to Spartanburg every day. Just from January 1st of this year to June 30th, we've had $1.2 billion invested in the county and 3,100 jobs coming off a pandemic. So, I mean, these are not just record numbers. These are earth-shattering numbers for us.
Well, and congratulations to you for it, sir. But and understanding that your job is economic. Well, you're you know, sideline, as it were, because you've actually got a day job. But you know, your job, as it were, is economic development in Spartanburg County. What kinds of jobs are coming in? Are the companies staying? Is it costing any tax revenue outlay? Those kinds of things, because it can't all be sunshine and light.
Well, that's a great question, but it has been all sunshine and light for us these 6 months. And again, Kai, you know, I've been here when we did not have any jobs and nobody wanted to move here. And in, you know, 1992, when BMW decided to move here, that changed everything for us. And we've actually worked hard to prove to the world that we're not a one-hit wonder. So what's happened this year, I think we've proven, you know, to our existing base, you know, all these manufacturing investors, you know, 4 weeks ago, Oshkosh Defense, international company, they're building a manufacturing facility here that will do all the United States Postal Service new electric vehicles for the whole country right here in Spartanburg.
How much of what you are able to do now is because of assistance from the various virus relief packages? And I'm asking because it looks like that tap may well be run out, given the state of play in Congress right now. You know, there was some bipartisanship early on, certainly under President Trump, right? He passed a big package, and President Biden passed his package. Let me ask you, do you see more help from the federal government coming, and are you going to be all right without that?
We don't see any impact from the federal government on our success.
Huh, that's a bold statement.
I mean, it is bold, but I know these companies. I deal with every one of them in negotiating them to come here. But what's happened for our explosion of growth, the supply chain, COVID taught companies here in the U.S., you can't be all over the world in a pandemic. So I think you're seeing a lot of these companies move back, and particularly Spartanburg. Plus, we're seeing tremendous population explosion. They're coming here in droves because this is where jobs are. The quality of life is out of the world. You were here. You saw we're an hour from the mountains, 3 hours from the beach.
It was a little humid. I don't know if you remember that day we were having lemonade. Oh. It was a little rough outside.
It was not just a little humid. It was hot as all get out. Yeah.
Last thing, sir, and then I'll let you go. Are you keeping an eye on the Delta variant? I mean, you know, South Carolina's been open for a while. Unemployment benefits have ended in June. How worried are you about another wave?
I am concerned. You know, I got my vaccine publicly, and as did everybody else. We're still encouraging folks because it is a problem, and our task force will stay on top of it.
Dave Britt, he's the chair of the Spartanburg County Economic Development Committee. Mr. Britt, it's good to talk to you again. I really appreciate it, Dave.
Thank you, Kai. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Take care now. Let's talk about weather in this country already this summer. Heat waves out west, droughts as well. But it ain't just here and it ain't just us. There's been a drought in Brazil. And that, and maybe all of us hitting Starbucks post-lockdown, has put coffee prices, and we're talking the commodity here, the beans, but also eventually your morning caffeine. Those prices have hit their highest prices in years, and the Department of Agriculture says it expects coffee consumption globally to pass production this year. So Marketplace's Matt Levin explains how coffee roasters and coffee drinkers might be reacting.
A roaster in Austin, Texas, Cuvée Coffee used to make its money selling beans to fancy coffee houses. But in 2020, survival depended on the stay-at-home baristas, says founder Mike McKim.
Our grocery business and our direct-to-consumer business increased exponentially.
The drought in Brazil is forcing Cuvée to pay more than $3 a pound for beans, up from about $2.60 last year. McKim's going to raise prices, which could be dangerous. Grocery stores carry shelves full of cheaper brands.
Yes, 100%. I think they're going to be more price sensitive.
But McKim's confident most of his customers will pony up. And 2020 was a big year for consumers to try something new, says Caleb Bryant with the market research firm Mintel.
We saw a lot of experimentation going on. Consumers either trading up to more premium coffees, attempting to make specialty coffees at home.
Brian says price jumps won't stop most remote workers from paying for fancier blends. It's the Maxwell and Folgers drinkers that may shift to even cheaper store brands. And as far as local cafes go, Brian says a few cents more for an afternoon cold brew will be a small price to pay to get out of the house.
72% of remote workers say that buying coffee and tea away from home helps break up the day.
Coffee is famously volatile, and the price spikes are nothing new. Ted Fisher researches the coffee industry at the University of Vanderbilt.
I'm old enough to remember in the 70s, it was like oil and coffee. And like middle class America felt it because the coffee prices got so high.
Expect even more volatility in the future. Climate change is making droughts like the one Brazil is facing more frequent. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Sometimes you can't hear us on the radio. We get that, but never fear, we have a podcast as well. Check it out. Listen whenever you like. Coming up.
If you were to rent your house, how much could it rent for?
All right. Who's got a rental property calculator handy, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 126 points today, 0.3%, 0.3%, close to 34,996, oh, so close to 35,000. NASDAQ up 31 points, 0.2%, 14,733. S&P 500 grew 15 points, about 0.3%, 43.84, new record highs all the way around. Disney added 0.4%. The media giant's movie Black Widow was released this past weekend. Maybe you heard about it. Don't know how you missed it if you didn't hear about it. Group drew in $80 million in domestic box office receipts, the highest for any movie released since the beginning of the lockdowns. Also not so bad, given that it was on Disney Plus as well. Cheesecake Factory, also up 0.4% today. Bond prices down, yield on the 10-year treasury, 1.36%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. According to the Office of Personnel Management, which is basically HR for the federal government, 85% or so of federal employees work outside the Washington, D.C. area. Among them now, the headquarters staff of the Bureau of Land Management, which the Trump administration moved from Washington to Colorado. BLM is in charge of more than 245 million acres of federally managed land in the United States, more than any other agency. The question now, though, is the front office going to stay in Colorado? Madeline Beck from the Mountain West News Bureau went to Grand Junction to find out.
The new Bureau of Land Management headquarters is renting space in a sprawling four-story brick and glass building near Grand Junction's airport. The agency isn't the only tenant, but it's likely the most controversial. Under the Trump administration, acting BLM director William Perry Pendley touted its move west as economical and good policy when he first announced it.
We want them closer to the lands they manage and the people they work with, rather than two and even four time zones away in Washington.
He pointed out 97% of BLM employees already lived in offices around the West, but critics say headquarters and senior officials need to be in D.C. where the funding and power is. According to BLM, nearly 300 BLM employees retired, quit, or found other jobs after the headquarters announcement. And only three D.C. staffers have officially moved to Grand Junction. But what do the people of Grand Junction have to say? I found Jack Mueller sitting outside a coffee shop in Grand Junction on a hot afternoon.
I don't know what to think of the people who are saying we don't want to move.
He and his wife, Linda, are retired. They say the headquarters move was a good idea, and Linda doesn't get why D.C. staffers wouldn't jump at the chance to live out west.
Well, anybody that wants to go back to D.C. deserves it.
Plenty of other people I talked with around Grand Junction also want the headquarters to remain here, like resident Dee Stancy.
I just love that we would have the opportunity to have them here locally, and I think it truly makes more sense.
But others weren't so sure, like Miranda Purcell. She'd heard the arguments that moving BLM headquarters out west would benefit the public lands the agency oversees.
On the flip side, people said, well, all the decisions are made in Washington, so it's putting them out here and removing them from the conversation. So I don't know which one I agree with.
One thing is certain. Moving headquarters here is an economic boon to the area worth about $9 million a year in jobs alone, according to the Grand Junction Economic Partnership. Diane Schwenke heads the city's Chamber of Commerce.
That economic impact for us really at this point comes primarily from those jobs and the multiplier of those 40 plus employees.
Multiplier meaning the money the BLM employees would spend on goods and services that support other jobs in the area. And things have been challenging for the town. It used to rely more on the booms and busts of fossil fuel production, which hurt the community for years after the 2008 recession. But now, Schwenke says they're diversifying into manufacturing and tourism, and they survived the pandemic in okay shape.
I'm glad that I've actually seen our community in Mesa County survive the COVID pandemic economically much stronger than a lot of other places. And that has not been the traditional history of our community.
It's not just people in Grand Junction who want headquarters to remain. Colorado's Democratic Governor Jared Polis says he doesn't agree with how the move happened, but he wants headquarters to stay now that it's there. Aaron Weiss with the nonprofit Center for Western Priorities disagrees. He says the headquarters should be closer to lawmakers and other agencies.
everything BLM does involves interfacing with the Fish and Wildlife Service, with the Park Service, with the Department of Agriculture, which oversees the Forest Service.
But maybe there's a third way so the government doesn't have to choose between D.C. or Grand Junction.
Probably realistically a split probably makes more sense.
Chris Brown is owner of the Brown Cycles bike shop in Grand Junction.
You don't have to be, you know, sitting next to somebody to govern and manage things.
That way, Brown says those who want to live in Grand Junction, like those who want to move, can. And the rest can stay in the powerhouse that is Washington, D.C. From Grand Junction, Colorado, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
You know, sometimes you make a promise with the best of intentions, but then events just conspire against you. Such is the case today with me and this program and inflation. Been trying my darndest not to overwhelm things with inflation stories, but we'll get the latest reading on the I word tomorrow morning when the Bureau of Labor Statistics graces us with the Consumer Price Index for June. May, as you might or might not remember, showed the biggest annual increase in consumer prices, 4.9%, in 13 years. And here is why I'm telling you this. Housing is part of the CPI, Consumer Price Index, and housing prices have been rising like crazy, as you know. So you'd think you might see that reflected in the monthly number. But the shelter component of inflation, as it's called, has actually stayed pretty steady for the past decade. Marketplace's Amy Scott went to try to figure out why.
To understand how the BLS measures housing inflation, I went straight to the source.
I'm Steve Reed. I'm an economist in the information analysis section of the Consumer Price Index program at the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
How's that for a government title? Reed's job is to explain the CPI and the data behind it to the public. He says the goal of the CPI is to measure changes in the cost of living over time. To do that, it tracks prices for a bunch of different things like gas, groceries, clothes, and housing. The overall housing category includes furniture, appliances, and utilities, even lodging away from home. But the biggest component is what we pay for our primary residence. The price of rental housing is easy. The index looks at changes in monthly rents. But most Americans own their homes, and that's where it gets tricky.
When you purchase a home, a large aspect of that purchase is an investment aspect. It's not a consumption aspect. And we are trying to measure the price change for consumption.
To do that, the Bureau uses a calculation known as owner's equivalent rent.
The idea there is that if you're living in your home, your cost of sort of consuming the shelter provided by that home is what you're foregoing by not renting it to somebody else.
The CPI estimates owner's equivalent rent by looking at actual rents for comparable homes in the same area. But remember, housing is just one item in that basket of goods, and because it takes up a bigger chunk of most of our budgets, it carries a bigger weight in the overall measure of inflation. Real rents and would-be rents make up about a third of the CPI. To come up with that weight, the BLS surveys us about how much we spend on the items in the basket, including rent, and for homeowners.
That's where we have to ask this question. If you were to rent your house, how much could it rent for?
Seeing as how most homeowners probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about renting out their homes, they guess. You may think all that guessing is why some economists have a problem with the way the CPI measures housing inflation.
It's always around 2.5%, regardless of the economic conditions.
Jiro Yoshida is a business professor at Penn State University. He says it's not the guesses, it's the hard numbers, the ones based on actual rents that distort the inflation rate. Renters who stay in the same place for a long time typically only see small increases every year. But when they move out, rents often jump a lot for the next tenant. Yoshida thinks the CPI has too few of those renters in the mix.
That appreciation rate tend to be underestimating the reality because that survey misses the huge adjustment between long-term tenants.
Yoshida and some colleagues created a different measure of housing inflation based on new leases. And voila,
Between April and May, we have 8.4% annualized inflation. So that is significantly higher than 2.5% CPI rent.
And if you plugged that bigger housing number into the overall CPI, inflation in May would have been nearly 0.5% higher. Not a small thing if you're on Social Security and your cost of living increase is pegged to the CPI, or if it determines your annual raise at work. The BLS has tweaked its formula, but not enough, Yoshida says. And if you're wondering how all this measures up for the Fed, it uses a different index, which Yoshida says also underestimates housing inflation. But we've done enough for today. Maybe next time. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, saw this on CNBC, data from the National Association of Colleges and Employers. Paid internship pay, it turns out, is the highest it's ever been, $20.76 an hour. That is the good news. Summer 2020 data, by the way. The bad news is that fully 40% of internships are still unpaid. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context before we do, though. Vaguely I-word based, but in a news-you-can-use kind of way. Bond yields, as we have mentioned a couple of times the past couple of weeks, have fallen quite a bit since inflation became a thing and people started talking about it back in February. One way that decline manifests is in mortgage rates. Freddie Mac says a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage can be had on average at a rate of 2.90%. That's the lowest those rates have been since, coincidentally, February, when inflation became a thing, when people started talking about it. Our daily production team includes Anis Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. One last thing to do today that I meant to do on Friday, but honestly, it kind of got away from me. We said goodbye last week to Scott Tong after 16 years with Marketplace. He opened our Shanghai Bureau back in the day. He has reported far and wide for us ever since on virtually everything this program covers. And now he is on to do something else. We wish him well, of course, and we'll miss him. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.